Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Autism Stories. I'm your host, Doug Bletcher, the founder of Autism Personal Coach. Autistic people are the true experts of the autistic experience, and Autism Stories is where we interview autistic people to learn from their stories, experiences, and get their insights. If you would like to be notified about each week's episode of Autism Stories, we suggest you subscribe on your favorite podcast listening platform. We would also appreciate it if you could give us a positive rating and review, as it will help others to learn about autism stories. On today's episode, Jessica Michaels joins us to discuss neurodivergent leaders and helping them to leverage their talents, and as well as being a stand-up comedian. We hope you enjoy today's conversation. Jessica, thanks so much for joining me here on Autism Stories.
Thank you for having me.
Wanted to learn at the beginning of our conversation, where does your story in the autistic community begin?
So I was diagnosed in my late 30s. Of course, looking back on my life, I can see from, you know, as early as I can remember that the signs were certainly there. I just didn't know about it until well into adulthood.
And it appears you've shifted in recent years from working in leadership positions at some pretty large organizations to becoming a neurodiversity leadership consultant and speaker. What went into that decision to shift your career in that way?
I realized that there was a lack of information for autistic people who were in the professional space, and even less information for people who were in the professional space and wanted to be leaders. I don't think there's anything about autistics that inherently make them unfit to be leaders, but you do have to find your own way to lead for sure. And the business world, frankly, is not set up for autistics either. So I try to work it from both ends, from the individuals to the businesses as well.
Now, you help neurodivergent leaders to learn how to leverage their talents. And one of those things that we as leaders are challenged with is how to communicate with those that we are leading. What have you found are some of the best ways or strategies to do so?
Mm-hmm. Autistics, in my experience, love context so much, you know, and I want the backstory. I want to know how we got to where we are, all of the facts that could possibly go into making a decision. And when I'm communicating with other neurodivergent people, that's great because they tend to love context as much as I do. However, for a lot of people, when they're communicating that way with a lot of context, if you're on the listening end of that, it can be hard to find the forest through the trees. It can be hard to understand exactly what I should be taking away from this conversation. So what I call bottom lining is very important. So what does the other person at the end of this communication absolutely need to know or do or act on? And that is something that can help clear up a lot of miscommunications.
For me, I've coached autistic people in a lot of different areas, but one of them has definitely been employment. And through the years, I've sort of learned that there are lots of neurodivergent people in leadership, but they're not necessarily open about their neurodivergence for, you know, probably could impact their standing. So I'm just wondering, like, with you working in some of these larger companies, what do you think some of the things could be changed to help people to be more open about these things? Because it's not just about coaching. To me, the most important thing in employment situations is about the environment, about, you know, about those types of things. And then coaching kind of comes second.
Absolutely. Because there's only so much that an employee can do to bring to the workplace in a way that is quote unquote acceptable for colleagues and the manager. And to me, the key is the manager. Honestly, when you think about somebody's experience with a company, their supervisor, their direct supervisor, provides about 80% of that experience with the company. So if the company is fantastic, but you have a manager who isn't understanding or who isn't helpful or isn't inclusive, then it doesn't matter what the values are of that company, because the person who is directly responsible for kind of how you interact with the workplace is, it can't make up for that. It can't make up for that. So I think in addition to from the top down, from executive level down, you know, having a company that's willing to be inclusive and make that a part of their kind of their DNA as a company, that's great. And you do need that. But that frontline manager or supervisor, that is a person who needs probably the most training and education, because without them, it doesn't matter what else you're going to try. It's not going to be successful.
Now, I think for many of us as autistic people, one, I think a lot of us are really good leaders. And two, I think we're really funny. So I always love to talk with autistics like you who have a lot of experience as stand-up comics. So I read that you perform stand-up in some of the finest comedy clubs to the seediest dive bars, which I thought was great. I was wondering what's been the best type of environment for you to perform in?
Oh, the more people, the better. I have always loved to be in front of an audience since I was quite little. And stand-up actually is how I met my spouse. My wife and I were both booked on the same show. She's a comedian as well. And so I like just having as many people as I possibly can to entertain, for sure.
So that's a great example of kind of the benefits that we like, that we don't expect when we pursue our passions, as you met your wife through. Yeah, I mean, it's just so often this seems to be the case.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that I tell people, you know, my clients who maybe not satisfied with their love life in particular, is that you need to fulfill yourself first. And often it is in those pursuits that allow you to have that first point of connection with people, whether for friendship, you know, or a different kind of relationship. But when you find the things that feed your own soul, then that's often a good path to connecting with other people.
So when you're a stand-up comedian, obviously communication's an important part of what you do. So I was wondering if doing stand-up has helped you to communicate in other aspects of your life.
Absolutely. I have found that humor is one of the best ways to get people to remember things or get people to pay attention when they might not be inclined to do so already. I mean, if you think of corporate training, nobody says, oh, I can't wait to go sit in this 2-day training in this conference room at this Marriott hotel, you know? But if you can use humor as a way to engage people, you can kind of sneak your message in there along the way, and it tends to stick with people. It also really provides a good contrast. To me, educating people who are not exposed to autism involves a lot of sharing personal experience. And when you can contrast something with humor and then provide kind of that heart-wrenching personal story, that 180, that kind of whiplash, really makes those personal stories stand out even more. And ultimately, that's what I want people to connect with, is the fact that we are people and we're people with feelings. And so it can be a really good tool in many different situations.
Maybe on the negative side of comedy, there can be people that can be pretty rude and disrespectful that go to watch up stand-up comedians. So that makes me think about the intersection of being an autistic female doing stand-up. Were there times where you felt unsafe with people who paid to see you perform? And how did you go about navigating those situations? How did you deal with that kind of conflict?
Yeah, fortunately, that was fairly rare, but it certainly did happen. And what was interesting to me is the different ways male audience members and female audience members would heckle a comedian. If it was ever a guy that was giving me a hard time, they'd say, "You're not funny." And if it was women who were heckling me, they would say, "You're fat." That's what they always went to, is weight. It's like they thought, if I can say something that's going to really cut this person down, it's going to be weight. And so, which I thought was fascinating that there were those two distinct patterns. And typically, if somebody's heckling, alcohol is most often involved. But what's really interesting to me is after the show, about 75% of the time, person who was heckling would come up to you afterwards and say, "Boy, I bet you're glad I was here because I really helped you out." A lot of times people think that they are contributing to the show and that you as a comedian wouldn't be able to do your job if they weren't there, which of course is totally untrue, but somehow people have gotten the idea that they need to participate or you won't be funny, which is not the case. So I try to provide some education in those moments for sure. But I did learn that one of the ways my autism helped me is if something is awkward or something is weird, call it out. Because me on stage, I'm hearing the same thing everybody else in the room is hearing. And so if there's somebody who's being belligerent or distracting, it's not just me that's affected, it's everybody in the audience. And that's a really great way to get the rest of the audience on your side, is to call that person out, because everybody else in this room paid to be here too. And they didn't come to see the person in seat 24B spout off drunkenly. They came to see a show. So that helped too.
I hate hecklers at comedy shows, and I think I would go to shows more often, one, if there weren't more hecklers, but two, if I wouldn't be anxious about a comedian potentially calling on me when I'm in the audience. That the idea of that and having to talk in front of those group of people and spontaneous communication like that has always made me very nervous.
Well, I'll tell you a secret. From the comedian's point of view, it is impossible to see more than like four rows into the audience because the lights are so bright. So if you sit closer to the back, then it is really hard for people to see you, to call on you. Plus, as a comedian, I tend to not want to call on people who are not volunteering, you know, but if somebody raises a hand or if somebody does something then that draws my attention, I'm much more likely to call on them because I don't want to involve someone in the show who is not interested because they're probably not going to give me what I need anyway. So if you sit in the back, you're in the dark, you are virtually invisible to comedians.
I appreciate that tip, Jessica, because I definitely would like to go to more shows because I feel like good stand-up comedians, they're some of the most intelligent people in our population because they're observing things and they're kind of sharing those things in a way that might get people to think differently about life. And I'd love to see more autistic comedians out there because I think sharing about the autistic experience with our general population, I think, can only be helpful in educating all of us.
I think so too. You know, and I think now that I look back my time doing stand-up, I am positive that I interacted with a lot more neurodivergent people than probably they even realized at the time, because there's just something about the willingness to, you know, people sometimes when I say something, they'll say, "Oh, that was so brave." And I go, "Oh, wait, what did I say?" And it turns out most people aren't willing to call things the way that they see them. So they're not willing to ask the question, or they're not willing to make the comment. But as a stand-up, that's really often what you're doing, is you're looking at the same events that everybody experiences, but you're looking at them from a slightly different angle, slightly different point of view. And for somebody who's autistic, really, that's just the way that I thought anyway. And I know that that was the same for a lot of my fellow comedians, maybe who, I mean, I didn't know about neurodiversity at the time I was doing stand-up, so I know a lot of them didn't either. So I'm sure there are plenty of neurodivergents doing stand-up already, for certain.
No doubt, definitely. And then Jessica, lastly, how can our listeners learn about you beyond this interview?
Absolutely. They can go to my website at coachjessicamichaels.com. And I have all sorts of info on there about coaching. I have courses, free resources, all sorts of stuff. So coachjessicamichaels.com.
Well, Jessica, thanks so much for making the time to talk with me today. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to Jessica for the conversation. To learn about Jessica, please check out the link in the podcast description for this episode. Here at Autism Personal Coach, our clients are the experts, our coaches are the guides. The majority of supports for autistics are not helpful. They try to fix us, not support us. That's why many are confused when we say our clients are the experts, experts of their lived experience. Our clients are the experts for what has worked for them and about the things they need and want in their lives. Our coaches first listen to our clients and then ask thoughtful questions, offer resources, and strategize with our clients so they can get what they need to thrive. Would you want a guide in your life to coach you to help you to get the things you desire? If so, then visit autismpersonalcoach.com for more information. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Autism Stories, and if you did, if you could tell a friend, foe, or anyone you know about it so they could have the same enjoyable and educational experience as you when listening to Autism Stories, it would be very much appreciated. Until next time, I'm Doug Bletcher of Autism Personal Coach. Talk to you then.